I'd like to address the comprehensive nature of God's covenant with Abraham by looking at what some people call a second covenant. I'm not sure about that, but we can use that terminology for a while until we figure it out. Maybe we won't figure it out, but we'll try to. So, the first covenant, did God make two covenants with Abraham, or did God make one covenant with Abram and another covenant with that same man after his name was changed to Abraham? We saw that when he was 99, El Shaddai made a covenant with Abram, and at 75 as well. Then after Abram was called upon to make a what would be the greatest sacrifice anyone could ever be called upon to make, there is a little bit of a difference in the covenant that is spoken of in Genesis 22. Before we go there, in Genesis 17, in that account of the covenant, the significant feature of it is a large plurality of people and nations that will come, starting with just one birth that was otherwise, apart from God, impossible. El Shaddai would not only make an otherwise unfruitful couple fruitful, sufficiently to have a child of their own, of both of them, that's the important part, but he would make exceedingly fruitful the lineage that was to come from and through that seed, which was namely Isaac. Whole nations would come thereby, and not only a plurality of nations, but a large plurality, many nations. A great many people overlooked the words of Yahweh regarding the many nations altogether, but we don't want to do that. That's a great omission, since God was faithful to fulfill the first part of the promise in Isaac. Then why should he not be faithful to fulfill the other parts, and especially the part about the plurality of nations? It is, in other words, not just the Jewish people who can say we have Abraham as our father. Another special feature of the covenant is that among the multitude of Abraham's progeny is a royal or a kingly line, the posterity of which will presumably become rulers of some of these nations that are spoken of, who owe their common ancestry to one common father and mother. The promise to Abraham is also seconded when God makes the same promise to Sarai, who at the time is barren, and then her name is changed to Princess, or Sarah, which harmonizes well with her new role. That is, she's going to have kings of peoples come through her, or from her. Ishmael, whom God will bless exceedingly and make fruitful, by contrast, will also be made into a great nation, but that's singular, and the father of 12 princes. All of them, even Ishmael, were circumcised, which is perhaps why so many in the ancient Near East culture practiced circumcision. Another special consideration of the covenant is the gifting of the land that is presently occupied by others. It is also an everlasting tenet of the covenant. And this is about more than ownership. It's about possession of the land offered by God to Abraham's descendants. One more aspect of Yahweh's covenant with Abraham is that it was a gift of God, not something deserved by the people in question, not even Abraham. And it's something God gives graciously. Centuries later, after the giving of the covenant, Yahweh made a covenant with them that was conditional. But this one that we're talking about is not conditional. While Israel was still together as one nation, a covenant was made with them that if they broke faith with God, God would no longer be held to his part of the covenant. Now, this is tantamount to annulling that covenant when they do break it. But the one we're considering is all on God. He assumed responsibility for it and no one else. In essence, while God and Abraham are both party to the covenant, God pledged to keep his covenant inviolate, and God himself would be to blame if it were not. That's important. All this is important, but that's a real important tenet to it. Be it known that the Lord usually provides two or three witnesses when he does things of this nature. One example of the doubling is when Pharaoh dreamed the same dream two times, whereupon Joseph told Pharaoh that the reason for two of the same dream signaled that God was signifying that the dream was from him. The witness to the gate blessing, which we find in Genesis 22:17, was also given two times. It is said there in Genesis 22:17, but later to Isaac's wife, after she consents to go with Abraham's servant to become Isaac's wife. Rebekah was told by her brothers, she was blessed by her brothers, with an interesting blessing, which is a doubling and making sure that we understand that it comes from God. They said to her, "May you, our sister, become the mother of thousands of ten thousands," or become thousands of ten thousands, literally, "and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." Or gates, I think it's gates. Surely this was a second attestation from God that this part about the gates is from God. That part of the blessing is also messianic in the part that says, "In thy seed shall all nations," that is, goyim, "of the earth be blessed." Surely the covenant with Abraham comes through one person, but it also points to one person in the future, a one and only specific son of promise in both cases. And that's the way that the blessing is stipulated in Genesis 22:18. It comes through one seed, singular, as well. At the time, no one on the earth would have understood the blessing spoken of as being messianic or pointing to Jesus, the unique, one and only unique Son of God. We find all that out later in history and through the New Testament, specifically through the Apostle Paul, who wrote, "Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed." He does not say, "and to seeds," plural, as referring to many, but rather to one. "And to your seed," that is, Christ. Paul wrote that in Galatians 3:16. Paul's point is made based upon the subject noun being singular, as opposed to plural. Many seeds. It speaks of one seed. The blessing would come through the sacrificed son, who was the only promised seed through Abram and Sarah. The second covenant, or as some people call it, the second covenant, we haven't really decided that yet, was made many years after the first and follows on the heels of Abraham passing the test of offering his one and only unique son that comes through both he and Sarah. We find it in the text of Genesis 22:16-18, which we looked at last time on this channel. And it comes on the heels of Abraham acting out his faith, his trust, his total dependence on God. Look at some of the salient points of what is said there. It's unconditional. God says, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord." Repetition of the multiple amounts of children is there, to which is added that they will possess the gates of his, not their enemies. This is the perfect type of what, or rather who, is to come. And it's also the perfect type of the Father. Abraham is willing. He does not hesitate that morning when he takes Isaac to be sacrificed, which of course does not make anything any easier. But he knows that he and his one and only unique son will return together. He knows there will be something that precludes them not returning together. Hebrews 11:9 points out that Isaac was received back as from the dead, as a type. So Isaac is bound. That shows that he's willing to die and give himself without any reservations. So too, the father is willing to sacrifice for real, and I'm talking about Jesus now, his one and only unique son on Mount Moriah, which is not a test. The Son of God, later on, spoken of through the prophecy in the covenant and the promise of the covenant, will be bound, nailed in fact, held down on a makeshift altar, the cross, at the behest of his Father, to fulfill the will and purpose of God, who will supply the sacrifice himself. That is true in the sense of Isaac, and it points to Jesus as well. Let me read you a quote. "A son of promise, an only son, from whom so much is expected, sacrificed and accounted dead, then in symbol raised from the dead." And the two special reasons for this text being, on the one hand, an encouragement to faith, and on the other, that the Son may live to fulfill his God-ordered destiny. The prototype of this is another Son of Promise, an only Son from so much, so very much, is promised and expected, sacrificed on the tree, dead. But that the two witnesses, the word, the symbol of the promiser, might not fail, the divine Father who gave back that other son raises from the dead his only son, that he might become the author and finisher of our faith, that he too might live and become all that was promised and expected of him, and thus fulfill his glorious destiny. We can ask no more, for both the lesser and the greater son, the type and prototype, are concerning the flesh, sons of Abraham. And that comes from J.H. Allen. The book is entitled Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, on page 17. It's where you find that. That covenant had to succeed. Both aspects of it, all aspects of it, have to succeed. Though the people later sinned and failed, that covenant was based strictly on God. It is of a necessity, then, a very important principle, promise, covenant on which, or upon which, Christianity rises or falls. This Abrahamic covenant is so critical that it depends strictly on God himself. For God swore by himself because there was none greater for him to swear by. If left up to us, it would never have happened. Hebrews 6:13 speaks about God swearing by himself because there was none greater for him to swear by. It seems then that there must be many nations that are in existence even today. People who descended genealogically from Abraham and Sarah, and those nations are in possessions of the gates or entrances, perhaps even cities, of their national enemies, unless the time for that has not yet arrived and the promises not yet fulfilled. But they will be if they are not. The situation may speak of two covenants, I'm not sure, or scenarios brought about by the covenant expanded by God as we go along in Scripture, made long ago with Abraham, but becoming more clear as time goes on. Truly, you have to get a hold of the fact that one part of the covenant, if it's only one covenant, speaks of multiple genealogical progeny that is uncountable, while the other aspect speaks of a messianic covenant that also seems to have an uncountable progeny, that although it is begun genealogically through Abraham and Sarah, it also points to spiritual progeny. Regardless, both of these aspects are based upon the integrity and the oath of God. We're going to leave it there for this week. Until we see each other again, Lord willing, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace.